You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora everyone and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 7th of October. I'm your host Mary Margaret and I'll be with you for the next hour, as well as my producers, Ben and Connor. Hello.
Good afternoon.
How are you guys?
Great. Wow.
Nice weather.
Yeah.
I'm feeling finally. Like it's summer all weather. Already. All weather. Yeah. Ugh. We've got a busy show today. It's Mental Health Awareness Week and Ben is speaking to Jane Stevens about her story. Yeah.
Yeah, it's running from 8th to the 14th of October. So
yeah, tough and important matters. So
absolutely.
Be wary. It's Worry Week on The Wire once again and we are learning about cultural appropriation. Fashion Nova recently released a geisha-inspired costume, so we are speaking to a faculty member of Auckland University's Japanese department. Then we're going international and Connor is talking about the Brazilian election.
Yes, we're going to look into what's going on there and also give you a little insight into the makeup of Brazilian society to give you an idea of who's voting, why they're voting, who's running, etc.
Very comprehensive. And finally, for the Green Desk this week, we chat about gene editing and a discussion paper to get people talking. As always, hea ha o whakaro. Get in touch with us with any thoughts that you have. I'd love to hear from you. Tuku pātuhi mai. You can text us on 5395 or why am I? Give us a call on 309 3879.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Just a warning to our audience, this next story contains content pertaining to people taking their own life and some language that might be considered derogatory. Discretion is advised. People cross the road. That's how Jane Stevens describes how many people treated her when her son Nicky took his own life in 2015. It's Mental Health Awareness Week in New Zealand and I wanted to take a closer look at families who have lost loved ones to suicide. How do we treat these people after the fact? Since losing her son, Stevens, who was already known for taking active roles in her community, has become really quite well known around New Zealand for her cause to change the way we deal with mental health. She's now not only an advocate, but also a real advisor to other parents whose kids have taken their own lives. She said before, she does this because these services are not being adequately provided elsewhere. I asked Jaden Stevens what compelled her to get so involved in a cause many New Zealanders simply don't know how to address.
My own personal experience with the loss of my son to suicide and wanting to try and contribute to the prevention of any other families ending up in the situation that we've found ourselves in, and years of experience within the mental health system trying to access the supports that we needed for our son, trying to prevent the tragedy that happened. And since Nicky died, we've been overwhelmed by the number of families coming to us experiencing similar problems, particularly in regard to attitudes in the community, accessing services through the mental health system, the impact on families. So it's not really been a choice in one sense. You know, we have a huge problem in New Zealand with suicide. The numbers are greater than our road toll, and that just shocks me every time I think about it. You know, how did we ever get to that place? So that's been my motivation, and my passion is to see transformation both within our mental health system and in our community.
One of the suicide awareness campaigns you've been involved in is the SHOE project with Yes We Care. Why do you think that resonated so much with New Zealanders?
Look, I think one of the issues is that there's been such a stigma and such a silencing around suicide and around mental health. What we found as we travelled the country was just this avalanche of families who for the first time were able to actually feel like they could share their story and come together with others who have had the same experience. And it's a really lonely place to be when you're faced with the isolation of being suicide bereaved. You know, people cross the road. I mean, I experienced it myself. You know, people don't know what to say to you. People avoid you. You know, it was one of the things that I think was kind of a release, you know, for many people, that actually it's becoming okay to talk about it and to ask for help.
And Māori suicide rates are disproportionately high in New Zealand, as you know. Can you expand on what a mental health system that caters more to Māori might look like?
Well, I think a mental health system that caters to Māori will be whānau hapū iwi centric, and that means putting families and at the centre of the care that they're receiving. And at the moment, it's a very medical model. It is totally not working. We, you know, one of the things I am passionate about is the normalisation of mental health and bringing it back to our communities, bringing it back in a way that our whānau are supported to be resilient, to be the caregivers that they must be. But at the moment, what we have is families, whānau, who are basically, you know, out there trying to do their best with no support. So, you know, I see healthy communities that have all the resources that they need. One of the issues for me is that there is not any acknowledgement of the underlying causes around the huge spike in Māori mental health and suicide. And, you know, we have to get to grips with the fact that we have huge impacts from colonisation in this country. And while, you know, it's still a dirty word, it has to actually be addressed. And it's one of the things that's dear to my heart, and along with other whānau who've been impacted by suicide, I'm taking a claim to the Health Kaupapa Inquiry to try and highlight what's happening to our young Māori men.
You were already heavily involved in your community before, but how has your role changed since your son passed away?
I've always been involved in community, that's true. It's changed significantly. I'm a totally different person than I was before. And, you know, much of my work is around supporting other families who've been affected by suicide. I can't help but take what's happened with me and everything I'm involved with. And it, you know, it's been one of the good things in a sense that I've been determined to make sure that the silence and the stigma around suicide and mental health is challenged. So that's certainly something that I take into all areas of my work in the community, and challenging those in positions of power who need to understand that change has to happen, that we need transformation of our mental health services. And I think that is starting to happen. I think that people are realising that what we've got is failing so many people in this country. You know, we're talking 1 in 4 New Zealanders in their lifetimes being impacted by mental distress, mental illness. You know, that's huge.
And what's one thing you would like the general public to take away or learn from Mental Health Awareness Week this year?
I think for me, one of the things that I think a lot about is the stigma and how deeply ingrained it is in the culture in New Zealand. I think one of the things that we can all do is to actually reflect upon the way in which we use the stigma in our everyday lives. And I think we all do it. I know I do myself, even though, you know, I'm one of the most passionate advocates. And particularly around our language, if we think about that, you know, there's around 250 labels for people who are experiencing mental illness. And, you know, they just slip out in everyday conversation, you know, things like nuts, loony, mental, crazy, weird, freak, disturbed, retard, you know, all the things that we're scared of seem to be focused around mental health, you know, the boogeyman, schizo, you know. Even our children's programs, you know, a lot of them, I think it's something like 46% of animated programs refer to mental illness in some way. I mean, that has to change. We need to be normalising mental health in the same way that we do broken legs, heart problems. You know, it needs to change, and it needs to be on an individual level.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Ben speaking to Jane Stevens, and of course, if you need to, don't hesitate to call Lifeline. You've got the number there, don't you, Ben?
I do. So if you need help, free call or text 1737 anytime to talk with a trained counsellor, or you can also call Lifeline on 0800 543 354 or free text 4357.
Stay safe out there. We'll be right back after a song. This is Daz by Brick.
Okay, you're stranded on a desert island and you're only allowed 5 CDs. Who do you take?
I own like 3 CDs, so I guess all of those?
An MP3 player loaded with 5 albums.
Who has a standalone MP3 player?
Fine. You're stranded on a desert island. You have food and water to sustain 2 live bands. Who do you pick?
Drive Island, a must attend live drive with your pals Johnny and Big Hungry. Free Cara Joe's coffee, games, prizes, and dazzling performances from Princess Chelsea and Cindy. 95 BFM Drive Island, Friday, October 19th, 4 till 7 PM at Allen Melville Centre.
OMG, I'm obsessed with this podcast.
Oh, true crime histories. Or Grimm's Missingsville. Is it Criminal Yarns? Craig T. Nelson's Murder Tales.
No.
I got it. Tragedy Vultures. I love Tragedy Vultures.
Nah, it's one of the other ones where they watch bad movies.
Tacky.
Expand your podcast horizons. All of 95BFM's excellent shows and segments are available as podcasts on iTunes, RSS, or whatever podcatcher you're into. Never miss out again. 95BFM Vcasts. Subscribe to your favorite shows now.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
It is indeed time for another Worry Week here on The Wire, and we're learning about cultural appropriation. Fashion Nova, an American fashion company, recently released a geisha-inspired costume, an assembly of their version of a kimono, sash, and hair sticks. Originally, they spelt geisha incorrectly, and some reports say it was first being labelled as a, quote, sexy geisha costume. We are now joined by the University of Auckland senior Japanese lecturer Rumi Sakamoto. Welcome, Rumi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
So to start, this costume is just one of many. And I wonder, how does it feel for you personally when Japanese history and culture is objectified as a commodity and portrayed incorrectly?
Well, I don't think there's much problem because there's nothing, it's nothing new, right? Madonna has done it and Katy Perry has done it. And last year, Curly Cross, photographer for Vogue, got into trouble for using the image of the geisha and so on. But, you know, the cultural appropriation is usually about adopting elements of one culture into another when there is a clear power relations between the center and margin. So for me, this comes across as a form of cosplay. You know, it's a bit silly. It is a bit orientalistic, but it's not racist. And we have to remember that today's Americans don't see Japan as an exotic other anymore. Their neighbors, their friends, and it really doesn't come across as a cultural appropriation that is problematic. It's different if they are using Native American costume. There's much clearer power relations and the history of the Native American massacre by the American white Americans.
However, it is probably kind of safe to assume that a lot of the people buying Fashion Nova's costume might not even really know what a geisha is. Do you kind of want to explain what facet of Japanese history is being?
The geisha?
Yeah.
Well, they're not prostitutes, but they were the high-end female entertainer during the Edo period. And they were more an artist, I guess, than a prostitute. And there is a bit of misunderstanding there.
Yeah. And an American student activist identified that problem herself. She said that she felt the costume was insensitive because it fed hypersexualization of Asian women. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I really think it's a costume. It is a bit silly, but it doesn't necessarily lead to the sexualization of Oriental women. I think we have come a long way.
Okay. The Japanese Auckland meeting, which is a club at our university, they told me that they think that it was inappropriate for the company to sexualize their traditional roots that was significant to them. And they said that the fact that it was a non-Asian person modeling the outfit, they said that was a bad attempt at interculturalism.
Yeah. At the end of the day, if people mind, then they do mind. And for example, if Japanese Americans are actually feeling offended by then I think it will make problematic.
Mm.
And it depends on the, for example, the intention of the wearer too. You know, if there is a racist intention, and tries to use this costume in order to portray Asian Americans or Japanese American in specific way, then obviously that will become more of a problem. But I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong about the costume.
Okay. And you are a lecturer of Asian studies, is that correct?
Yeah, in Japanese.
So I wondered, your students have grown up, you know, under 21st century commercialism, as you were saying, which I guess some people would argue has given rise to a lot of new forms of appropriation. So do you know, for your students, is this a key concern of theirs?
Not that I'm aware of. You mean the Japanese students?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think if anything, people who worry about cultural appropriation of this time is non-Japanese. By and large, for example, last year when the Vogue image got into trouble and the photographer actually had to apologize on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. The majority of the Japanese people responded, we don't understand what's wrong with this. This is a form of the art expression. There was no reason for her to apologize and so on. Whereas in places like from the US, there were much harsher criticisms.
Fashion Nova in particular, who made the costume, they're an American company, and New Zealanders, you know, we don't get into Halloween as much as Americans do, but do you think that this is, it's something that's worth here in New Zealand stopping and having a conversation about?
If people want to, yeah, sure, but we probably have other things here, which, you know, like, if there's a misappropriation of the Maori culture here, for example,
right.
I think that's what people should be caring more about. Sometimes it's easy to make fuss about something that doesn't have direct link to, you know, who you are.
Sure. Rumi, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
See you later.
Okay, bye.
Worry Week on The Wire.
You're on 95BFM and it is 26 minutes past 12. We'll be right up back after this. Here's No Name with Self.
Maybe this is the album you listen to in your car when you're driving home late at night, really questioning every god, religion, Kanye bitches. Maybe this is the entrance before you get to the river, a heaven before the heathen, no reason for you to like me. Maybe this your wife, he just wanting a clean divorce. The baby ain't really yours, it's really for baby's teeth and the chicken wings under season. Y'all really thought a bitch couldn't rap, huh? Maybe this your answer for that, a crack era with a Reagan administration that niggas are still scared of. Nah, actually, this is for me. This one for TT at the wake, serving the mac and the cheese. This one a small apology for all the calls that I screamed. Mr. Money Man, Mr. Everyday, he got me. Mr. Wiping Me Down, Mr. Me Love, Mr. Miyagi. Miscellaneous, Mr. Molly inside my sake. Incredible, incredible emptiness in my body. Heaven's only 4 feet tall, I set my ringer to it. Fuck your rapper, homie, now his ass is making better music. My pussy teacher, ninth grade English. My pussy wrote a thesis on colonialism and conversation with a marginal system in love with Jesus. And y'all still thought a bitch couldn't rap, huh? Maybe this your answer for that. Good pussy. I know niggas only talk about money and good pussy.
Iridangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Connor is taking us to Brazil now.
Indeed. We're going to talk about the Brazilian election, which I've heard, I'm sure you've heard a lot about. There's a far-right candidate who's just won the first round of the election with 46% of the vote, which is not enough to fill a majority. The second guy is trailing by 28%. What I'm going to do, that's all going to come in the thing. What I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on, there's three main issues in this election. There's crime, unemployment, and corruption. There's one issue that kind of unites the three, is at the heart of Brazilian society, and that is discussing, so we're going to get to that, and that's discussing race and class in Brazil and how Brazilian society is made up, so that you understand the voters, you understand why they're voting, and the historical stuff that has gone on to understand why they've gone for far right candidates. And yeah, I guess what I'm going to try and do is just give you kind of quick explanation on on it, but I will give a bit of a disclaimer. First thing is, there is a mention of sexual assault within this piece, so do, if you are affected by that at all, or if it's something that would potentially trigger, then I would advise tuning out. Equally as well, I'm going over about 500 years worth of history and the election and a whole load of socioeconomic stuff in about 12 minutes. If I'm touching on stuff and then moving on very quickly, that's not because it's not important. That's because I'm trying to get through a lot of content in a very short space of time. So if I seem like this happened and then this happened and then this happened, that's not me delegitimizing the importance of what happened. That's just me trying to cover it and give it mention as much as possible within these 12, 13 minutes.
Let's get into it.
Yeah.
This is Jair Bolsonaro. He's been called the Donald Trump of Brazil. He's one of the country's most controversial political figures, and he's rising in the polls for the 2018 elections.
You're going to face an army captain, an extremely strong presidential candidate in 2018. You can be sure of that.
Under the dictatorship, he served as a captain in the Brazilian military. And he's been a congressional representative for the state of Rio de Janeiro since the early 1990s. But mostly, he's been known for his bombastic, homophobic, xenophobic, racist, and sexist rhetoric. Sound familiar? The Intercept published an article about him in 2014 titled, "The Most Misogynistic, Hateful Elected Official in the Democratic World." It highlighted a laundry list of his most egregious remarks, including telling a fellow lawmaker that she didn't deserve to be raped, and that he would rather have his own son die in a car accident than be gay. He's been fined for his comments. He's defended the dictatorship, applauded the killing of landless workers, and carries a gun. He's promised to fight violence with violence, and his support is growing amid the country's worst financial recession ever and a massive ongoing corruption investigation that has already taken down dozens of top political figures.
Brazil is currently having one of the most important elections in its history. If one looks at the Brazilian flag, the motto in the middle of the blue globe reads, "Ordem e Progresso," or "Order and Progress." This election proves that those three words have vastly different meanings in modern Brazil, to either side of the political spectrum. This year's election comes among one of the worst episodes of political turmoil in the country's history, and it seems that amidst the chaos, instability, and distrust between people and representatives, Jair Bolsonaro and his far-right Social Liberal Party, or PSL, are coming out on top with 46% of the vote in the first round. But this was not enough to secure a majority to form a government, and on the 28th of October he will go into the second round in a head-to-head battle with Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, who is facing an uphill battle to regain trust of the Brazilian people for his party after former party leader Lula was imprisoned for corruption.
Fernando Haddad is only here running for president because former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva couldn't be. The former mayor of São Paulo only became the Workers' Party candidate after the electoral court barred Lula from running. His opponents say he's just a stand-in and that Lula da Silva would effectively run the country from jail, where he's serving a 12-year sentence on corruption charges. His first high-profile position was as education minister in Lula da Silva's government in 2005. He would go on to win his first run for office in 2012 as mayor of São Paulo. But 4 years later, he lost his re-election bid.
Fernando Haddad's conciliatory style and modern image were key elements in the choice of his name to run for the Workers' Party. And he also has a big advantage in not having been touched by the corruption probes that hit his party and put many of its officials in jail, including former President Lula da Silva.
If Haddad does reach the second round, a big question is whether his clean past would be enough to overcome the disappointment and disdain felt by much of Brazil's society towards the Workers' Party, known as PT.
In Brazil today, we have a clear-cut division in the society. A sector that hates PT, and I think that this is a problem, is a kind of an irrational hate against the PT, and it's very divisive, and so some people think that they won't vote for the PT. It doesn't matter why, it doesn't matter what can happen. It will be very difficult for him if he doesn't establish this bridge between the PT and between the other parties of the center.
The political situation in Brazil is very representative of its political history and social makeup. Like its former colonial ruler Portugal, Brazil does not have a long tradition of democratic freedom or the rule of law. Its history has largely been marked by authoritarian regimes, be they outright authoritarian or just flawed democratic regimes. Democracy only came to Brazil in the 1980s, and only because Brazilians who once benefited from authoritarianism started to lose trust in the military regime's ability to maintain the consistent growth of the economy. Essentially, as Spain, Portugal, South Korea, and Taiwan were all making the transition from right-wing nationalist authoritarianism to free liberal democracy, Brazil's military saw the writing on the wall and headed in a similar direction. But unlike Portugal or Spain, where members of the authoritarian establishment were ousted from power in non-violent civilian-led coups, the establishment largely remained the same in Brazil, guiding liberal reforms from the seat of power. Yet today, amidst corruption, economic stagnation, and rising unemployment, many Brazilian voters are starting to look nostalgically back to the 60s and 70s as a time of stability, progress, and dignity for Brazil, irrespective of the widespread torture, press intimidation, poverty, and institutionalized racism that was encouraged under the military junta. In short, Brazil appears to be sliding back into its old habits. But who are the Brazilians voting to make Brazil great again? Well, to explain this, we need to talk about race and class. Brazil has its own unique relationship with these concepts. Socioeconomic divides perpetuate society on a scale more extreme than the US. In fact, they're probably more comparable to South Africa. But the definitions of what constitutes white and what constitutes black are not definitions we might recognize in the English-speaking world. We'll start with the white Brazilians and who they are. This is important because their story is key to Brazil's political values, considering they have largely held the political power. Portugal colonized Brazil in 1500 and created 15 colonies along the coast, and Brazil as we know it today came into being. They took the land, tried to enslave the indigenous people who didn't die from the introduced diseases, but gave up on enslaving the indigenous Brazilians after they realized they were outnumbered, when expeditions to capture slaves were always followed by large-scale attacks and killings at Portuguese settlements. So when sugar was found, they brought African slaves over instead. Essentially, the British ripped off the idea of America from the Portuguese in Brazil. White Portuguese and others came in droves with promises of land as Brazil expanded right into the Amazon, taking more and more land. The key moment in Brazilian history, though, was in 1821. The Portuguese royal family saw Napoleon of France expanding and saw the writing on the wall, fleeing to Brazil. To maintain power, they turned Brazil from a colony into an integral part of Portugal. The problem was when Lord Nelson won the Battle of Waterloo and exiled Napoleon, and Portugal decided around the same time that they didn't want absolute monarchy anymore, so they forced the king back to Portugal to sign a new constitution. Brazil was on board with the new constitution except for one thing. Brazil would have been downgraded to a colony again and would have lost any say over their own affairs, including trade. Brazil liked their newfound independence and had the king's son, Pedro, on board with their cause. So Brazil seized the moment, declared independence, Pedro became emperor of Brazil, and the Empire of Brazil became incredibly wealthy. They took more land, invited even more white people over from Europe, and imported more slaves than any other nation on earth. But the aristocracy still ruled. They did not believe in the Chartist ideas the UK, France, Holland, the US or Australia had implemented at that point. The idea that any man, irrespective of means or status, could exercise political power. Hence why white Brazilians, to this day, still believe that they have a right to the power over Brazil. Almost an ingrained sense of status that goes back to Brazilian and Portuguese quasi-constitutional monarchy. And the idea that they were chosen and that they are the only ones fit to decide over the affairs of the country, either because they're rich or through their bloodline. As for black Brazilians, here's a little background to the infamous favelas that define the poorest of Brazil.
If you go to a Google map of Rio de Janeiro and put it into 3D mode, you can see what the city looks like as it was designed by urban planners. But you'll notice parts of the city that don't look like the rest. The people who live in these parts of the city with the clean lines and the well-thought-out design are called people of the asphalt. The people who live in these parts of the city are called people of the hill. Even though the people of the asphalt and the people of the hill live closely intertwined throughout the city, they live vastly different lives. These informal communities that look like houses stacked on top of each other, sprouting out of the jungle, are called favelas, home to both vicious drug gangs as well as some of the most peaceful, creative, and resourceful people in Rio. A favela is a community that was built without any oversight of a public authority. No zoning, no building codes, no public services. These places just kind of grew out of the hills over time thanks to two main factors. First was slavery. Brazil imported 11 times more slaves than the United States did, and Rio alone was home to more slaves than the entire American South. Slavery ended in 1888, and free slaves, still denied many rights in society, built these informal communities on their own.
On top of this, because the Protestant Victorian values of indigenous equals savage and satanic, and European equals godly and righteous, weren't really a thing in Catholic Brazil like they were in the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, miscegenation was very common. However, not in the progressive way that we know interracial relations today. Slave owners regularly sexually abused their slaves, and escaped slaves regularly had relations with indigenous Brazilians. Hence why this is generally Brazil's view on race in a country as mixed and diverse as it is.
Something very important to keep in mind is there's no one-drop rule in Brazil like there is here in the US where I live. So interpretations on identity are in the eye of the beholder. I could walk into a room, 20 people could think of 20 different things of what I am or what I look like. Not necessarily good, or I shouldn't say that. It's not necessarily better, it's just different, okay? And sometimes make things a lot more complicated. So keep that in mind.
So what this means is that unlike New Zealand, where, for example, a bit of Māori identifies you as Māori, you are Māori. In America, where being half black means that you are black, that is your identity, you are black. Racial identity in Brazil's culture of institutionalized racism is based upon the individual's complexion. So that would be facial features, lips, hair, skin tone, eye color, all play a part, and it is essentially society that judges your literal physical appearance to be either black or white. It's not uncommon in Brazil for, say, one sister to be black and another sister to be considered white, yet they literally come from the same parents. Hence, there is a saying in Brazil that says, money whitens, meaning marrying into quote-unquote white mixed-race Brazilians elevates status. And this unique racial dynamic expresses itself in the income inequality. White Brazilians are statistically more likely to gain an internship, regular employment, and management positions. In fact, both candidates in this race would be considered white in Brazil. And this is a very clear power dynamic there, that race is not decided by your genetics, it is decided by how society literally views the individual. The difference is Bolsonaro represents the white, middle class, and upper class. He represents their worries and their fears. He plays upon old segregationist ideas of paternalism towards black Brazilians that have existed for centuries. He appeals to fear of crime by promising police further liberties to use violent force in favelas and the interior Amazon regions. He represents an idea among the white Brazilian minority that their loss of absolute power caused the current chaos. In a sense, he plays towards that old Brazilian idea that they are chosen to run Brazil with impunity to maintain order. So what does this mean for the poorest of the country? Well, Brazil has made strides in lifting millions out of poverty under Lula. But over the years, the poorer Brazilians have been expelled from their land, pushed further out of the way, and have had opportunities disappear for them in the stagnating economy. Jails are filling and crime is rising. And it seems that under Bolsonaro, both would be solved, but in the brutal ways dictators have usually solved those issues. The 28th of October will not only decide Brazil's leader, but it will decide its political direction. Brazil took the plunge to follow its former colonial ruler into the unknown of democracy. That date will decide if the largest Portuguese-speaking nation on earth decides to keep at it.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
There was a comment made recently by, on, I think it was Al Jazeera, I believe. I can't confirm. Either way, it was a Brazilian political commentator said that one of the key parts of this election is that after the military dictatorship, there wasn't much of a conversation around the horrors that happened there, the tortures, the killings, the abductions, the forced expulsions, the racism, all of that stuff. There was never really an open conversation. People just kind of were quiet and moved on. And it left, like you said, it's left a lot of quite extreme feelings unmanaged sitting under the surface. Like, America's had conversations about race, Portugal and Spain have had conversations about their experience about fascism. Brazil's never had that conversation, and he said it seems to be that this is the moment where that conversation has reared its ugly head and people have said, okay, we need to talk about this. And so, yeah, the 28th of October, we will see if Brazil stays at the experiments of democracy that they're trying out, or if they slide back into their old habits of authoritarianism.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Connor.
No worries.
We'll be right back after Dapper by Domogenesis.
It just needs that Okay. Yeah. Hold that, yeah. Light. Come on now, hold up. Smoke that. Come on, don't stop till you feel it. That, baby, you got to. Hold on, yeah. Smoke. Shake that pretty ass when it's flashing and light off of one glance. Can only imagine the hype. Trying to figure out what's being your plans for the night. Cause I ain't fucked as good in weeks. Got a fresh cut, now I'm looking for the freaks. Fresh car wash, we still put your hands on the Jeep. Use your etiquette and bring sand to the beach. Been all around the world to keep running. Shorty, when I hold my hand, it ain't nothing. Mariah said if it's worth time to say something. And when they tell me I'm out my mind, I ain't budging. Yeah, I'm sorry if I'm so overzealous. Cause I ain't find no energy like you on this planet. So yeah, just put your number in my hand, yeah. And I'ma put that bitch up with fan mail, you dig me? Hold that, yeah. Light. Come on now, hold up. Smoke that, fire. Come on, don't stop till you feel it. Baby, you got to. Hold on, yeah. Smoke that, fire. Really good, nice to meet you. Maybe we can smoke a little Indonesia. We can shake up the world like a GOC. Your love song so strong, you don't need no features, no. Roll a Jimmy up and spark it last. Keep it never hit me in my heart that fast. I watch your brain, whoever start that gas. The road to love, baby, you either gonna park or crash. It's muscle memory, walking down similar paths. I feel the energy, maybe that's the way that I'm feeling from all this energy. I'm way, way bigger than what they tend to be. And you could be my Mary Monroe, I'm John Kennedy, you know it. You feel it? Cause I ain't feel this rhythm in a minute. Get it faded till we fall. Got an arch so I hit it with a spring, summer, fall. If I want it, I'ma get it. Come here, what's up? Come on now, hold up. Smoke that, fire. Come on, don't stop to hold it. Baby, you got to. Hold on, yeah. Smoke that, fire. Now I can turn a pussy to a kiddie pool. And I can swim around until my fingers prune. But if you stick around, I'll probably sing a tune. Yeah, if you stick around, I'll probably roll another up right now. Killing it groove. Come on, smoke that, fire.
This is the Green Desk on 95BFM.
This week on the Green Desk, Jack had a chat with Barry Scott, a professor of molecular genetics at Massey University. They talked about a discussion paper just released by the Royal Society Te Aparangi. The independent not-for-profit body provides funding and policy advice for the sciences and the humanities. The group released this paper with the hopes of beginning a conversation about gene editing in New Zealand. To start off, Professor Scott gives us an overview of what exactly gene editing is.
So what happens in nature is
everything is subject to light, sunlight, UV. Every organism out there is undergoing some very low rate of spontaneous change in its genome. Within a population, there's a lot of variation in terms of the changes at different genes. And so what plant and animal breeders are doing all the time is trying to select for the variants that they want, you know, a different apple colour or a different height of a tree or whatever. What gene editing can do is, starting with plant, an animal, embryo, microorganism, is put in a machinery. It's got the complicated name of CRISPR-Cas. It breaks the DNA. It causes a break in the DNA, and that needs to be repaired. And if left to its own devices, the cell will repair that, but generally in an imperfect way. So you get a few small changes at that site as part of the repair process. And so that can basically knock out the function of a gene. So if there was a gene that determined seed colour or seed shape or something, you could put, if you knew the gene involved, you could put the editing machinery in, cut that gene and allow it to repair and potentially remove the function of that one gene. There is another version of that where you provide a template as part of the repair process and you can alter the gene or put in several genes. So it's quite a wide range of different changes you can make. But what's different about this new technology from the old is it's very, very precise in terms of where it occurs. And big difference to sort of natural plant breeding is breeders have to screen hundreds, thousands of sort of natural variants to find the one they want.
So instead of waiting for a natural random trait to come out, you select the traits you want and go from there?
Yeah, it's just taken off exponentially. So it's one of those sort of big transformational changes.
Mm. And so what actually got you personally involved in this? Because, you know, a lot of us kind of just fall into different industries, but how did you get involved in molecular genetics?
Oh, it goes way back to the 70s when I was working in the States, and this was kind of the period when being able to engineer DNA. Genentech, the company that developed insulin in bacteria, was founded then. It was a pretty exciting time. It's just kind of continued since then, and so a decision was made to have a look at gene editing, and I got the job of chairing a committee to put something together. And what we've chosen to do is a series of papers. This is our third one now, and so we have a great big long sort of scientific paper, and then that gets distilled into something a little bit more user-friendly for the public.
As a committee, you've put out this discussion paper for everyone to get involved. Do you have a personal view of where you'd like to see gene editing move, especially from a New Zealand context?
I seriously think if we don't embrace this, at least in some way, and obviously it has to be done and considered and that it's all safe, then I think we'll be seriously disadvantaged.
Where do you think the biggest kind of potential would be?
Well, I think it's seriously limited by our imagination. There's just lots of things you can do, and this whole field, if you look at the international science, it's absolutely taken off. There's mushrooms of all things that don't go brown now available in the US from a very, very simple edit. There's pine trees, pollen is a big problem. Wilding pines is a big problem. These are not easy plants to work with, but that's one of the scenarios we've highlighted. It's not yet feasible. Some of these scenarios are kind of looking into the future a little bit, but we can see the potential for some clever people to come up with a way of doing this. If you have essentially sterile trees, then you remove the spreading problem. Yes, I think a lot of potential there. So that was one of the scenarios we painted, of course, in our five scenarios.
So on the show, we've talked quite a bit about the backlash against 1080 from these really kind of minority groups. But how do we move forward with science, with the public really behind it? Because it seems like with the misinformation out there, so how do we move forward without facing a backlash?
Well, that's a tough question, isn't it?
Sorry. Have you got the answers? What's the answer?
Especially in this mass media age of Facebook and everything else, you know, it's a big issue, as you know, in terms of alternative facts and this whole question around who to believe and what to believe. This is a key role for Royal Society Te Aparangi, is to provide expert advice, to get it out there, and to just make sure we provide good independent advice. It's very, very difficult to counteract false claims, exaggerated claims. Yeah, very, very challenging. That's really all I can say. the 1080 ones is in the real hard basket, because this is deviating somewhat from what we've done. But just personally, I'm a conservationist, and it's a real dilemma for us, because we've got a huge number of species on the brink, and we haven't got too many options available for us at the moment. So it's like everything, it's about choices. Are we going to do something to try and save the species, or are we just going to let it collapse and die and go? And we need more options.
I reckon if you can fix the Cody dieback problem with gene editing, I think everyone will just be behind you.
My goodness. Now, there's a very, very difficult one. And in fact, we've been talking about it today. I mean, that's an absolutely insidious disease. And, I really worry for the future of our kauri, because I've seen iconic trees in North America and Europe disappear with some of these horrible diseases. Mm. And, you know, once these things are loose, very, very hard to control, moves through the water, it's transmitted by animals. Oh, it's horrible. And, you know, to see these iconic trees of 2,000 years or more, and to see this creeping up on them, it's just horrible.
And just one final question for you. What do you think the biggest barriers are going forward with gene editing in New Zealand?
Oh, social acceptance. And I think this is very much why we're doing this, is to help inform the public, getting everyone on board. And it's not around the science, and it's very well known. You can give the people all the facts you want, may not change their views. So really got to look at, some of having conversations and finding what people are comfortable with. It's very much a sort of social context conversation we've got to have, putting up the alternatives.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another Tuesday. Thank you to all those who came on our show. We had Jane Stevens, Rumi Sakamoto, and Barry Scott. Thank you also to all of my producers, Ben, Connor, and Jack. And thanks most of all to you for tuning in. I'm leaving you with some Santa Gold today. This song is called Disparate Youth. Up next is The Wonderful with Gin. We'll catch you next week.
A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.